All right, team, let me tell you about NewZest, clean, plant-based nutrition products to meet the demands of modern life. And I'm super excited to announce that they are a sponsor of Micropedia. With over a decade of experience and a presence in more than 20 countries worldwide, NewZest has emerged as a leader in providing innovative solutions for those seeking healthier and more sustainable choices. In a world where people are looking for clean labels, easily digestible ingredients, and allergen-free options, NewZest delivers and totally has you covered. Clean Lean Protein is a plant-based protein powder and contains all 9 essential amino acids. It encourages recovery, vitality, muscle repair, and growth, and helps you hit your protein requirements, which you know I am all about. One of my favorite products is their Good Green Vitality. It's the gold standard in multi-nutrients. It's designed to make complex nutrition simple. The Super Blend is carefully formulated to address all aspects of health, 75 ingredients working together to support everything from digestion, immunity, and healthy aging, to stress, energy, and cognition in one daily serve. Grab yours today, guys, with a sweet 20% discount for being a listener of the show with the code Micropedia over at their website, and we will pop a link in the show notes for you to be able to do that. All right, now back to the show. Hey everyone, it's Mickey here. You're listening to Micropedia, and this week on the podcast, I speak to Dr. Eric Helms. Eric and I talk all about bodybuilding, the history behind enhanced versus natural, Eric's own decision to go down the natural bodybuilding route, and the journey it took for him to win his pro card last year in 2023, 19 years after he began in the sport, which just any athlete will know takes just so much determination and commitment. And so we discuss what his process of staying motivated and involved and just the things that he went through. Eric and I also discuss his nutrition strategy and his supplement regime, which by all accounts isn't that much, to be honest, for his competition shows in 2023, because as you will hear, he had several shows in the lineup to the competition that gave him his pro card. So it was super awesome to chat to Eric and also, of course, to ask him about what is next for him. So Eric has been on the show a couple of times before, and I've got links to those episodes in the show notes. He is a coach, athlete, author, and educator. A trainer since the early 2000s, he's worked in the US Air Force, commercial gyms, private training studios, medical fitness and strength and conditioning facilities. As part of the 3DMJ coaching team, he coaches drug-free strength and physique competitors at all levels. And as Eric and I discuss, he's competed since the mid-2000s in natural bodybuilding, unequipped powerlifting, and dabbled in Olympic lifting. And we do actually have a bit of a conversation around that. He earned pro status as a natural bodybuilder with the PNBA in 2011 and competes with the IBF at international level events as an unequipped powerlifter. Eric has published multiple peer-reviewed articles in exercise science and nutrition journals and writes for commercial fitness publications. He's taught undergraduate and graduate level nutrition and exercise science and speaks internationally at academic and commercial conferences for fitness, nutrition, and strength and conditioning. Not only that, Eric spends a ton of time both in his podcast, Iron Culture, and also for Mass Review Monthly, which is a strength and conditioning review. He does weekly or bi-weekly YouTube live sessions answering questions. So he is a wealth of information and is of complete service to his sport and enthusiasts like us who are super interested in learning from him. He has a Bachelor of Science in Fitness and Wellness. He's got an MS in exercise science and a second master's in sports nutrition and a PhD in strength and conditioning. He's a research fellow for AUT at the Sports Performance Research Institute New Zealand, and as I mentioned, he is also co-founder for MASS Monthly Strength and Conditioning Review. And I have got links to where to find Eric and his podcast and MASS and other podcasts with me. I've got all of those links in the show notes, so you can find loads of ways to connect with Eric there. Before we crack on into the show, though, I'd just like to remind you the best way to support Micropedia is to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast listening platform, because that increases the visibility of the podcast in amongst literally thousands of other podcasts out there, so more people get the opportunity to learn from the guests that I have on the show, like Dr. Eric Helms. All right, team, please enjoy the conversation.
Land, thumbnail, and title. So it's like now the algorithm has made even just putting out information suspect. So it is, we have new problems in 2024 regarding good science information versus access like we had 10, 15 years ago.
That's so true, actually. And, you know, you could be rolling in it right now, Dr. Helms, if you took advantage of that algorithm, given what I've just described, your presence on the internet. Yet you stay true.
My ethics constantly hold back my pocketbook. It's terrible.
Hey, so Eric, I'm so pleased to chat to you. Obviously, you've been on the podcast a couple of times, but I don't know that we've necessarily delved into your history and background in bodybuilding, but also just bodybuilding as a sport. Like, I'm super interested to sort of begin there and then talk about your own, journey is a really overused term, but it's the only thing I can sort of think of there. There you go. It's not overused. It's
trademark, the 3D Muscle Journey. I'll be sending you the royalty claim form after this.
Right. Roger. And of course, your most recent success with your pro card. So these are the things that I want to chat about today. Normally, I would have sent you a little bullet point of discussion points, but I mean, that's your 101 basically. So it's all about you. I figure you're not going to need to prep on that.
To be honest, if I do have to prep sometimes, because if someone wants, if it's an audience that is really going to actually benefit from me talking about like specific PubMed IDs and findings and stuff like that, I'm happy to prep. But most of the time, if someone brings me on and I need to prep for it, they're asking me questions that are outside of my wheelhouse anyway.
That's a good call. Yeah. I appreciate that. So first, I want to chat about bodybuilding. Mm. And I know that there is obviously natural bodybuilding, and that's the sport that you're involved intimately with. But then there is is it enhanced? Is that what I would call it? Bodybuilding,
you know,
what is the name for that?
I think most there are enhanced bodybuilders, but there are plenty of people who compete in non-tested organizations who are not enhanced. So
okay,
I would someplace say tested and untested is the most proper definition, because it doesn't make a claim about everyone who's competing in it, right?
Yeah. And would people who are like not taking any sort of substance which would prohibit them from being in the natural tested, would they also go up against competitors who knowingly take substances? Mm.
Yeah, it's actually pretty common.
Wow.
And this is more of something that you'll see in the States, because the NPC and IFBB Pro League are so large, and they're the most organized as far as a competitive structure. Like, they have a nationals, they have national qualifiers, they have a little more robust of a system. And you know, where you compete in the United States, being so geographically large, but also so reasonably well populated, has to do with what shows are in your local area. So, you know, if you go to a local NPC show, which is the largest untested organization, and you just go watch the novice division, probably more than half of those folks are drug free. Depends on the division, obviously. Like in the open men's bodybuilding, it'll probably be the largest percentage. If you were to look at, say, the novice women's bikini, it's probably the smallest percentage. And then there's also a question of, like, are you using a banned substance versus what is the dosage? How many are you using? How long have you been using it for, et cetera? But there's actually some surveys, you know, anonymous surveys, so they're more likely to be accurate, that indicate if you go to like a regional NPC show that can qualify you for nationals, probably a large number, but less than half of the competitors are using banned substances, or at least anabolic steroids. There's a recent one that came out of, I think it was led by Guillermo Escalante, so that's really good work on bodybuilding as well. But there is a point in especially the bodybuilding division or the women's physique division, the more muscular divisions, where to get to the highest level, it is not a question of whether you're taking something, it's how much and for how long. Like there are no Mr. Olympias, for example, maybe ever, or at least since like Larry Scott, and I probably think even then, so it was the mid-60s, who were drug-free, you know? And there probably haven't been any who've, you know, like top five in the Olympia or top 10. When we're talking about someone who is like the WNBF overall world champion. So for example, this year's Brian DaCosta, he's huge. Don't get me wrong, but he's, you know, 5'8", 5'9", and on stage at 190 pounds. If you're 5'8", 5'9", and you win the Olympia, now we're talking 250 pounds, 260 pounds.
Oh.
So like a 30 to 40 kilo discrepancy in stage weight at a similar level of body fat. So it's different.
Yeah, it is. Totally. And like, Eric, are there still, like, you know, I'm completely ignorant. This is why I'm asking you all the ignorant questions. As I understand, taking large amounts of anabolic steroids is not good for your health. Like, do you look at people in the non-tested sort of federations and think, mate, in 20 years you'll be really, you know, I'm not going to say you're going to regret doing that, because actually if we look at what elite athletes sort of what their overall goals are, a lot of them would say that, you know, that actually winning is their absolute primary concern. But like, is health an issue for these people later in life?
Yeah, and this isn't me, you know, looking at it as an outsider. This is from me having talked to many people who I know personally who are, you know, have committed to trying to get a pro card in the IFBB or who have competed at that level. You know, I very much sit in the natural bodybuilding community, but it's not like there aren't, you know, like crosstalk. And the bodybuilding community is large, and there is definitely some division between enhanced and natural federations and bodybuilders, but you know, you hang around long enough in the fitness industry, and especially as a bodybuilder, and you make friends with people, and I have no moral judgment against them. You know, personally, to me, it's just a matter of how risk averse are you? What values do you have, motives and goals behind your bodybuilding journey? And you know, some people make a different decision and they want to compete at the highest level in the enhanced ranks, and they're willing to accept those risks very much in the same way that someone who decides to be a professional golfer might be less concerned or like more risk averse than someone who pursues like free soloing, you know, and rock climbing. Right. So I've definitely seen some personality differences, but I would say on average, the typical enhanced bodybuilder is more similar to the typical natural bodybuilder than someone in the general population. So there's some camaraderie. I know a lot of people, and having talked to them, absolutely, at a certain point, they're making hopefully informed consent decisions about health.
Risk.
Yeah, the risk. And accepting what they're experiencing. And I think what you said about large amounts of anabolic steroids is critical, because you know, like we don't have, there's not great data that is experimental on this because of the legal status. We have experimental data on typically just single drug like testosterone, exogenous testosterone, up to reasonably high levels. But, you know, like the classic Bazin study, that's the lead author's name, that was 600 milligrams of testosterone compared to lifting or no lifting with or without it, and how they made more gains just from lean body mass. I don't know if it's actually, you know, actual muscular gains, you know, lifting and not taking steroids versus, you know, not lifting and taking steroids. That was 600 milligrams. If you're talking to maybe the average person who is trying to turn pro into the national level, not even a pro, they're probably, if you count like total androgen load, like 2 grams of drugs are taking. So more than 3 times that amount. So we just don't have data on that. The only data that exists on that, if you were to look for it, is observational in nature. So you recruit a bunch of people who are using this, and you can measure them over time at multiple time points, or you can cross-sectionally compare them to people who are not using it, who are matched for, you know, height, weight, and other, you know, covariates. And you can look at some of these effects in vitro or theoretical models and things like that. But the unfortunate thing is, like, the compounds that are being used are often, they've only been tested in animals. They may or may not be pharmaceutical grade. They're largely experimental. And there was a huge amount of pharmaceutical exploration that was done in modifying the testosterone molecule to, you know, get various androgenic to anabolic ratios and all this stuff. And I'm by no means an expert. I'm just kind of, I have a very surface level understanding of this, to get various different effects and different conversions and aromatase to water retention to impacts, even psychologically. There's everything from trenbolone to decadurabolin to actual testosterone that is not, you know, the synthetic version of it. There's orals, there's injectables. And most people are doing polypharmacy of these drugs that don't have data on them. And they're not just sticking to the class of anabolic androgenic steroids. Your typical person at that same level I'm talking about in the open men's bodybuilding division trying to get a pro card is probably also taking insulin. They're probably also taking growth hormone. And when they're prepping for contest, they may also be taking thyroid, clenbuterol, and potentially even other experimental drugs like DNP, which is creating uncoupling at the at like the molecular level to enhance heat production, which if overdosed, much like insulin, if there's not carbs around, can kill you acutely. And then in competition, because there's all this potential water retention related to the polypharmacy, they're typically taking prescription diuretics at while restricting water. So a lot of there are serious health complications when you're at that kind of level of dosage. It's not the same as say I'm on TRT. You know?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And are there doctors who work at the top of the field with these athletes? You know, I'm thinking, you know, in Tour de France, for example, there were medical doctors administering the performance enhancement drugs to the athletes, and it was under, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, under very controlled, it appeared, sort of situation. Like, or is that occurring?
You're probably referring to like the Icarus documentary.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I just got the impression that it was, you know, there were people who sort of knew what they were doing. But is it all just like the Wild West out there?
It's far more like the Wild West. And obviously there's going to be some regional differences here. Like there are known instances when we're talking about Olympic sports or professional sports in some cases. And yes, we're talking about IFBB pros, but it's not really a professional sport, right? Where you actually do have a doctor who is overseeing a doping program. I would say now in the modern era, that is far rarer, especially in countries that aren't as top-down organized politically. So in a New Zealand, a United Kingdom, an Australia, a U.S., there are, of course, instances of athletes using performance-enhancing drugs. But most of the time what is occurring is they are sourcing it themselves or through a contact. They have some ability to get these. There may be the closest thing to what you're describing is kind of a gray zone, sort of legal HRT clinic where you order it online and you provide very preliminary evidence that maybe you have low testosterone, which can range depending upon the quote unquote clinic to anything of, I feel tired lately and not even getting a blood test or a single, you know, blood draw to determine testosterone levels, which you could just, you know, diet for the day or, you know,
take it in the afternoon,
take it at a weird time. Exactly. Yeah. Right. All you need to show is that you're like low normal and then you can get a reason, like an unreasonably high dose to something that's actually a legit HRT clinic where they want to see serial testing and actually follow up endocrine society guidelines. no one's doing that. It's always the former. But far more people are actually pulling the trigger and just, let me get a source for what may or may not be an illegal substance for personal use in the country I live in. That's different in the UK to New Zealand to Australia to the US and how well that's enforced and the penalties. And then the doctors involved on basically a personal GP level, and they are simply doing like a minimal harm practice. You know, it's the modern medical approach to dealing with anyone who is self-prescribing drugs, right? You provide them information, and within the context of the decisions that they're going to make, you provide them, you know, the best care you can. So you encourage regular blood tests. You discuss with them the risks they're incurring. You are doing family screening for history of cardiac disease, etc. So when I talk to these folks who are doing it, they have a drug dealer essentially, and then they also talk to their doctor openly, ideally, about this, and they get regular checkups and regular blood work, and they will modify their dosage based upon their health to the degree that they're willing to incur risk. And they typically have a drug coach who is someone in the industry who is known to know about how to do bodybuilding pharmacology. And the kind of the scary thing, in my opinion, is that almost never are these drug coaches like endocrinologists or MDs. They are self-taught chemists, or maybe they have a degree in pharmacy or something like that. But they just have a lot of experience, and they've read some underground manuals on this stuff. So it is definitely more the Wild West than some kind of like 1980s, you know, East German doping protocol with sports doctors administering it. Although it does occur in some places, like there was a weightlifting scandal in Thailand that came out, etc. But that's typically not happening in democratized countries, if you will.
Yeah, super interesting. The way you described it, I was thinking about Breaking Bad, like bodybuilding Breaking Bad. It's like kind of similar, but obviously different.
Well, many times you are buying from the same people who would be selling recreational drugs, and you know, like there are a spectrum from talking to these folks who engage in this. There's a smart way to do this, of having a connection to an actual pharmaceutical grade supplier and going to see your doctor and all that, to, yeah, I know this bro at the gym who sells me stuff, and I just trust him that what I'm getting is actually what I've asked for.
Yeah.
And I never see my doctor.
Eric, because I know in your competition, like there are people, I'm sorry, his name escapes me now, but you were chatting about him on one of your podcasts, and he's like 52, and he took out. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Right. And so 52 is, you know, it's like middle-aged or just over middle-aged. Like, is there an age difference between those who are successful in natural bodybuilding? Is the longevity the same in the performance enhancing, or do they seem to exit more quickly? Like,
yeah, I don't have great data on this, like demographics, but there is actually in a book by, he's a historian, and it is, I'm forgetting that. I'm going to look it up really quick while I tell you basically the findings. It's basically going over the history of the Mr. America competition.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a really good book. He's written John Fair. So John Fair has written a lot about the history of bodybuilding, the history of physical culture. And in his book on the Mr. America competition, which goes all the way back to 1939 or 38, he talks about the age that the competitors died at in a certain excerpt from the 90s, after drugs had fully inundated professional bodybuilding and even high-level amateur bodybuilding. And it goes from being basically in line with what the expectations of life expectancy are for Americans in like the 60s and earlier, to then in the 90s being a lot of guys dying in their 50s, which is quite unfortunate. And there has been a lot of publicized deaths in the last handful of years of professional enhanced bodybuilders. I think it's pretty rare to see people competing as IFBB pros at the highest level into their past their early 40s, which is still pretty impressive for a sport in general. But it is really common, not just, oh, there's some interesting rare examples, for natural pro bodybuilders and pro in any division of natural physique sport to hit your peak in your 30s and 40s and then sustain that peak if you can stay musculoskeletally healthy and you can still train into your 50s without really seeing noticeable declines until you're in your 50s or 60s. And this is interesting, and it might be surprising to other people who are in the S&C world, but not specifically in bodybuilding, because they're thinking about bodybuilding as maybe a strength or power sport, or the training being equivalent to it. But the actual force you produce or the power is not the dictating factor. It's more of like the impulse, if we want to talk about it from like a biomechanics perspective. So the force time integral, right? So when you look at, I think it's interesting when you look at weightlifting, powerlifting, and bodybuilding, they have an earlier age out that scales with that. So there's actually been some demographic data on when do weightlifters hit their peak and when do they stop seeming to be at the highest level. And on average, and it's in the late 20s, with, you know, you go a standard deviation up, you get to your early 30s. In powerlifting, it's mid 30s, you go a standard deviation up, you get to your early 40s. So very common to see powerlifters at a high level in their 40s. And then I don't have demographic data on bodybuilders, but I can tell you from being involved in the sport as a coach and an athlete, very common to have people at the world level who are pros in their 30s and 40s. It's more common to see high-level pros in their 30s than their 20s.
Oh, interesting.
And so much of that just has to do with the time it takes to keep building muscle and building muscle and building muscle. And the reason why there's a discrepancy between powerlifters and weightlifters is because powerlifters, it doesn't matter how quickly you squat. It just matters, can you produce the force, overcome the sticking region, and then actually have maximal force production? And more often than not, like bodybuilders, in my experience, powerlifters are unable to keep training in the way they want because of, you know, if you lift weights heavy, hard, and progressively for competitive outcomes for 20 years, you're going to get some injury, and eventually that injury may prevent you from training the way you want. And there are more constraints on a powerlifter than there are on a bodybuilder. You know, like if you, there's no way of getting around it, powerlifter has to squat, bench, and deadlift. But if you have an AC joint that doesn't allow you to bench press anymore, you can start doing uneven dumbbell presses as a bodybuilder. You know, if your lower back starts playing up as a powerlifter, really going to make squatting and deadlifting hard. But as a bodybuilder, you can shift to back extensions for higher reps, and you can do, you know, hack squats. You know, if your knees start playing up with high loads, you can do blood flow restriction training. There's so many ways around it as a bodybuilder. You can be creative because hypertrophy responds to low loads, high loads, just so long as the proximity to failure is there, progression is there, not progression of load necessarily, just progressive overload of any type. So you can see that bodybuilders can sustain the stimulus necessary to keep growing, or at least maintain a peak for a much longer time. And there are numerous examples of people winning pro titles in their, or even their early 50s. And so for example, Jeff Alberts, for those who are referencing, he is one of my colleagues at 3DMJ, is one of our coaches, and he and I both competed at Worlds. And he was the oldest in the class of the pro men's lightweights out of 16. He placed fifth. He's actually the highest placing American in the competition, you know?
Crazy, yeah.
And I am no spring chicken myself. I placed seventh out of ninth in the middleweights and I was 40.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was the oldest in the middleweights. There were competitors older than me. Yeah. Jeff was the oldest in the lightweights, but there was also gentlemen in their 40s in that same class as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super interesting, Eric. And as you say, you know, you're in your 40s now. No, wait, I think I might have aged you up. You are. You're like 40, yeah. But you're 40, right?
April, I'll be 41. So you can say I'm in my 40s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And I believe you started like, what, late teens, early 20s in the sport?
I started training, like when I started seriously lifting, I started training for bodybuilding, not necessarily for competitive bodybuilding, but to get big and strong, basically.
Yeah.
And I started lifting at the age of 22.
Okay. And at that time, or not probably at that time, but when competing sort of came on your radar, was there a choice for you, as in natural versus enhanced, or were you not aware of the delineation at that point and just sort of gravitated towards what? I don't know.
Bit of both. Yeah. So it was available, but you had to be aware of it. And this was, it's not pre-internet by any means, 2004 when I started lifting.
Yeah.
I started lifting in, I want to say, May of 2004. So I had literally just turned, I just turned 21. So I started lifting when I was 21.
Yeah.
Too old to know when I started lifting. There you go. So, in May, I will have my 20-year lifting anniversary. That's exciting.
Wow, yeah.
So anyway, so natural bodybuilding, the first natural competition and organization of natural bodybuilders that I was aware of started in the late 70s. The big first proponent of it was actually a guy named Chet Yorton. And Chet Yorton is one of the very few handfuls of very few bodybuilders, only a handful, who've actually beaten Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, Chet Yorton beat Arnold, I think, when Arnold was like 20 or 19, and Chet was in his like 30s. So Chet was a high-level bodybuilder in the late 60s and early 70s. And this was right around the time where it became relatively known and relatively inundated that anabolic steroids were being used by bodybuilders. This first started in like the mid-50s, right around the time Nilivar and Dianabol, the first synthetic version testosterone, hit the market. And you could just go to your doctor and get them legally prescribed. It was very, very easy to get access to them. It was very normal. There were testosterone derivatives like synthetic, you know, injectable, but non-modified testosterone as early as the early 40s. But it didn't really become commercially viable until, I don't want to get into the history of it too intense, but there's something called a marker degradation that was developed where you could make testosterone from yams rather than having to get like kilograms and kilograms of like bull testicles or things like that. Like some of the original preparations were made, and the initial ones, the esters were very short acting. So you had to inject almost every day, or you had to put a pellet underneath your skin and it would slow release it. So yeah, it wasn't until the mid to late 40s until there was even a possibility of it kind of being something that people could use. And there were longer acting esters of testosterone. I think in 1951 or right around the end of 51 or 52, long acting injectable testosterone esters where you could do like, I think, once a week injections came out and were FDA approved. You can actually track down the FDA approval. So it was like the early 50s it started. And that was right around also the same time people started to speculate as to, hey, maybe this could be useful for a sports competition. And then when you look back at records of USSR weightlifting performance, right around the mid 50s, it kind of jumped up unexpectedly. And so that's statistical analysis of records. And then when you actually look at the historical data, there's a fabled conversation between John Ziegler and who is, you know, the sports scientist for the USSR and the US weightlifting coach. This is when he says, hey, you know, our weightlifting team is using steroids. And then Ziegler goes back. Sorry, I swapped who is the person.
Yeah.
Goes back and actually starts experimenting with some of the retired lifters at York Barbell with injectable testosterone with mixed results. They weren't huge fans of it, probably because of the side effects at the time and not really knowing how to mitigate them or knowing dosages. And then it was not until the clinical trials had been done in Nilivar and Dianabol, which was the big one, came out in 56 and 58, that all of a sudden now it's really common. And I think the first report of a high school American football player taking steroids was in 1960. So the 60s, it's really, it really starts to expand. But it was kind of like this new dirty secret, or maybe not even dirty at the time because it didn't really have the same connotation, but this new kind of like secret weapon that a lot of the pros were using in the 60s. So anyway, to circle back, Chet Yorton finds out about this in the late 60s. And he, because bodybuilding at this time is so tied into health and performance, almost every bodybuilder is also a weightlifter. Bodybuilders are seen as, bodybuilding is about building your health. It comes from that as its roots. It's starting to split, but it hasn't fully branched off. So you're getting this first time there's basically the competitive drive and the modern technological advances in pharmacology are starting to divide bodybuilders in terms of them having to make a values choice. And the values choice of we value health to a degree where we don't think performance-enhancing drugs is something we want to include in what we consider bodybuilding, started with Chet Yorton going, what the hell? And basically starting a natural bodybuilding organization, which didn't really become successful or mainstream until the 80s.
Okay.
So the late 80s, early 90s, if you track some of the still existing largest natural bodybuilding organizations, is when they were actually created and became popular. And there was also the awareness that the longer you took these, the more of an impact it had. So in the United States, in the East Coast, is where kind of natural bodybuilding was born in the late 80s, early 90s, and they started implementing polygraph testing, or the quote-unquote lie detector test, even though it doesn't technically detect lies. And that's the way of screening for, okay, we need you to be X number of years drug-free. And then when you win a pro card, or if you're a pro, when you win money, you also have to pass a urinalysis test. And now we're seeing in the modern era, as cost is coming down, we're starting to even see some out-of-competition urinalysis testing. So that's kind of the story of the development of natural bodybuilding. There was a time period, you know, before the 50s where all bodybuilding was natural. And then there's a time period where the most mainstream organization got inundated with drug use because it made such a huge difference. You know, drug use in sports is common to the degree that it enhances performance for that given sport. So it's common in weightlifting, common in powerlifting. But because there's not a perfect transfer to how much muscle do I have and how strong I am, it's not as ubiquitous in powerlifting as it is in bodybuilding. Because in bodybuilding, it doesn't matter what you do. It's just how much muscle do you carry? And like I said, 30, 40 kilogram difference at the highest level and people using the whole chemical warfare suite of drugs they can get access to at the highest safe dosages that they didn't kill them immediately. And the enhanced side compared to, you know, just someone who's genetically elite, who's trained for 15 years on the natural side. And you have this huge disparity in performance where, you know, the world champion in natural bodybuilding would probably be able to get a pro card, but not be able to compete at all if they chose the right show. Or maybe if they competed in like the classic division, which is a newer division in competitive physique sport that's kind of a throwback to the 70s and 80s, where they actually have weight limits at a given height. So it kind of caps the amount of drug use you can use. There are some examples of natural athletes getting a pro card in the untested classic division and doing decently well, like top 10 in a pro show type of thing. But we're talking about open bodybuilding. The disparity is so high that as soon as you turn pro, if you turn pro, period, it means you're incredibly talented, and then trying to compete is basically not going to happen. And we think we actually have evidence of this. So Ronnie Coleman, who probably most people have heard of, the story is that he actually turned pro as a natural athlete. And he actually did it at a drug tested event, the International World Championships in the IFBB, which are slightly different outside of the NPC circuit, and they are IOC recognized, and they do drug testing. It's not extensive, and I don't think they're really serious about it. But his roommate is a well-known natural bodybuilder who they both competed in it. And there was this circuit where a lot of the naturals who wanted to be in the biggest organization, NPC, would compete in what's called the Team Universe, which is one of the few drug-tested NPC shows. And that was where a lot of the naturals who wanted the largest exposure would go and wanted to be seen kind of with the NPC IFBB circuit. And then if they did well enough in Team Universe, the team portion is the US team that would qualify them. They'd go to the World Championships, and there they'd be competing against all the other nations who are trying to get an IFBB pro card, and many of them are trying to cheat the drug test, so they wouldn't typically do very well. So anyway, Ronnie Coleman goes there and he actually wins, claims drug-free. And probably the best evidence is that he was about 220 pounds or 100 kilos at 5'10 and a half, which is huge. Don't get me wrong. Looked incredible, shredded, amazing proportions. One of the best natural bodybuilders of all time, if he was to stay natural. But by the time he's at the peak of his career, he's competing at 130 kilos.
Yeah, so, okay.
Like, if he was on Garrett back then, it was such a low dose that he was able to then change something to put on the kind of difference you see between naturals and enhanced over time. So like the most obvious interpretation was that this guy was so genetically gifted that he could turn pro drug free, but then to become Mr. Olympia 8 times, rivaling Lee Haney, he had to hop on the gear, and then he was just as dominant. He was the most dominant bodybuilder of all time.
Yeah. Okay. And so, before I delve into you, Eric, the difference, is there a money difference when you compete?
Oh, yeah. At,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So is that like one of the reasons why people will go in the non-tested versus tested?
Yeah. I mean, so if you ever go to the Olympia, it is in Vegas. It's in a big stadium. It's got a massive expo associated with it. And when you compare it to other professional sports like boxing or MMA, it's not as big. But compared to something like natural bodybuilding, it is factors larger, tenfold.
Oh, wow.
Or different. So, for example, yeah. The Mr. Olympia winner this last year in the open men's bodybuilding division won $400,000 for winning.
Wow. Yeah. Right? Okay. Yeah.
If you win the overall at WNBF Worlds, I think the most that's ever been awarded, because you get prize money for winning your weight class, and the overall, it's like 10K.
Okay.
So yes. We're talking a 40-fold difference. And even if you mopped up the entire scene, like you did multiple different federations, world championships, like if you win the Jordan Cup, if you win the Mr. America, which has now been brought back as a protested event, if you win IFBB Worlds weight division and overall, and if you win the Natural Olympia, which is the PNBAs, you're probably looking at 30 grand. So like if you literally just like were God's gift to natural bodybuilding, and you just flew around the world and did every single prize money show, you would make 1/10 of what the Mr. Olympia winner won. And the unfortunate thing is that even as a pro athlete, you're paying an entry fee of $200 to $300 for each one of those shows.
Yeah.
You're paying for your own drug test. So your entry fees, that covers part of it, but the polygraph you typically have to pay out of pocket. And also you have to pay for those flights in those hotel rooms. So, you know, maybe let's say you're in the States, you're driving. We can bring down the cost maybe to... Man, you're getting like a Motel 6 type of deal, $500 per show. So yeah. You're probably spending to do all that competition, $3,000. So
yeah.
at the least, you know,
yeah.
But probably
yeah,
closer to like 5 or 10.
Yeah.
So it's,
yeah. And then,
yeah.
Yeah. That's huge. That's such a difference. And then of course, I mean, if I'm thinking about you, Eric, so when you began in bodybuilding and you were aware of the different divisions, did any part of you think, oh, like you'd want to go down the non-tested route or just, yeah. Yeah.
So when I started, I didn't know that natural bodybuilding competitively was a thing. So for 2004 and most of 2005, I was just wholly unaware of it. And then I joined the bodybuilding.com forums, which was the kind of proto social media at the time, and Facebook was just kicking off. And I became aware, and there was a contest prep forum, so people were logging their contest prep. And I went there seeking wisdom because my plan was sometime in 2005, maybe late 2005, early 2006, I decided, you know, I want to compete in this thing. Yeah, that might have been 2006. And I got on those forums, started reading people's experience. I started talking to local bodybuilders, and I started watching like the Olympia and reading Flex magazine like online, right? Going to bodybuilding.com. I think I watched the 05, 06, and 07 Mr. Olympias. And it wasn't until I want to say 2006 that I became like fully aware, like, oh, there's pro natural bodybuilders out there. You can get a WNBF pro card. And I found out going to Borders, I finally noticed, I was like, hold on, right next to Flex magazine, this natural bodybuilding and fitness magazine, which, you know, like if the IFBB NPC was kind of at the peak in this era of enhanced bodybuilding or untested bodybuilding, the big dog for tested, because of the magazine era, was the WNBF. The World Natural Bodybuilding Federation, starting in the late 80s, was owned by a guy named Chalo at this time, who wasn't a front-facing member of the organization. He had like his acting president and all that. But the reason why it's important to mention that he owned it is because he owned a magazine publishing empire. So he had like, you know, Men's Fitness or Fitness for Men Only, like 3 or 4 or 5 different fitness magazines. And Natural Bodybuilding and Fitness Magazine was the magazine of the WNBF, INBF. and you could look and see all the different competition results. You could see pictures of people, and you could get on the cover of it. And it was at Barnes & Noble's and Borders, which, for those who are not Americans or Canadians, those are like one or two in every city. And that was where you went to get books and magazines. It was a very big deal. So being on the cover of that could get you things. So nobody really goes into bodybuilding for the money, period. Enhanced or otherwise. Because even the enhanced guy winning 400K, he might be spending $2,000 a month on anabolic steroids.
You know? Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So really, you do it for the love, you do it for the art, you do it for the competition, and you do it because you're just drawn to it. But one of the ways, or the most common way, that bodybuilders make ends meet is not through the prize money they win, but potential endorsements, you know, working with a fitness clothing company, or more commonly a supplement company. So, the world champion who was pretty dominant in the early and mid 2000s, a guy named Jim Cordova, and he had this great muscle belly, this great shape, looked like he was 200 pounds. He only competed at 165, 170 pounds, but looked like he's 50 pounds heavier just because of his muscle shape and condition. Very Arnold-esque physique, a little shorter. And he was on the cover multiple times of this magazine, and it actually resulted in him getting a paid sponsorship from a very large supplement company, Muscle Tech, right? So that's the type of thing that you could see back then. And that all went away and changed with social media, and natural bodybuilding, because it's very mom and pop, has been behind the times, and it hasn't been able to provide anything near to the same kind of prestige and supplement sponsor opportunities you can get as an enhanced bodybuilder. So some people go that route for that reason, for exposure, but I think more so just because it's bigger and more organized. That's the choice that a lot of people make. But from an actual participation standpoint, there is actually a similar number of competitors in all of the natural bodybuilding organizations compared to the one very dominant untested organization. So there's a huge market for it. And in fact, the NPC IFBB is starting to do drug tested shows on a much higher scale, and they're trying to expand into the market of natural bodybuilding because they see the demand for it.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. So for you,
I never even answered your question though. Sorry.
That's all right. No problem.
To be very clear, like, I became aware that natural bodybuilding was a viable pathway sometime in late 2005, early 2006, became a huge bodybuilding fan. And I actually got to attend, I want to say in April 2006, a INBF, WNBF show that was a pro qualifier in Augusta, Georgia, when I was still stationed at the Air Force. Actually, I just got out of the Air Force, and my wife, Barbara, was still in, and we would move 6 months later. But I got to go to the show, and I got to be on the judging panel as a test judge, trying to help out the local scene. And I got to see live these natural athletes, and I saw a guy win a pro card, and he had these ridiculous legs. He was shredded. And they achieved these looks that, while definitely smaller, I really resonated with. I didn't really like the huge physiques of the IFBB pros. Like, I was attracted to Frank Zane, for example, as kind of a statuesque physique. And I really liked Pumping Iron, the documentary of Arnold and Franco Colombo and all those guys. And that was about as big as I thought looked aesthetic to me, which is just a personal judgment. So when I saw the physiques that could be attained, that there was a heavily competitive environment, you could turn pro, that they were getting polygraphed, and that it seemed like a level playing field, and it was a viable pathway, I immediately shifted gears. I went from trying to rationalize to myself the eventual decision of taking anabolic steroids in the United States at a time when they were vilified. This was right around the time they brought Mark McGuire and Jose Canseco in front of Congress and, you know, question them about their drug use.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that my family wouldn't respect that decision, and geez, do I want to deal with getting a drug deal and all that. And I was like, you know, if I hadn't been exposed to natural bodybuilding, I don't know how far I would have gone, but, I was definitely working on going, well, I love bodybuilding as from an artistic perspective, what it feels like to do something hard like that and push myself, what it's given to me from an emotional perspective and a cathartic experience, a positive, you know, thing in my life at that stage. Maybe it wouldn't stay positive if I'd gone down the enhanced route. But I didn't want to give that up. And I also knew that I had a competitive drive. So maybe I need to think about being able to do that. But when the opportunity to compete and not have to use anabolics presented itself, I was frankly relieved, because I knew my own mentality that if I was training as hard as I could, if I was doing my nutrition as well as I could, and if I was dotting every I and crossing every T, and I wasn't where I wanted to be with a reasonable time investment for my competitive outcome, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to up the dosage. And I knew that that was a slippery slope that I really didn't want to find myself on. So that's why I chose to go the natural route, is to kind of draw a line in the sand that was self-protective. So I had a little bit of foresight for, surprisingly, at the young age of 22, 23.
Yeah.
That I really don't, like, I'm really pleased with me thinking about future Eric, to be honest.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, nice one. Eric, is it fair to say that you've always been chasing a pro card? Is that, does anyone that go into bodybuilding... Okay, yeah. And I don't think everyone, I know there'll be people who will do a one and done, but in the initial phases, was that also something on your mind, like, that's where I want to be?
Yeah, I remember, and then I think there's a danger in when you start competing in something that you loved before you started competing in it, because it can definitely, that extrinsic motivation can supplant some of your intrinsic motivators. And that did happen to me. I remember saying to my wife during my 07 contest prep, you know, if I didn't think I could become Mr. Natural Olympia, I don't know if I would keep lifting. And as literally as soon as that sentence left my mouth, I was like, I looked at her and she looked at me and she was like, well, that's really weird, because you've been lifting for 3 years now and it's your whole life and you love it. And you, just because you couldn't achieve some outside thing, you'd stop. And I was like, yeah, that's bad. You know, like, that was my immediate thought. So, like, I became so obsessed with the achievement and what I, where I was going and the focus and the drive and my goals, that I had lost my, you know, connection to the journey, which is why I started purposely kind of retooling my thought process and thinking about, you know what, let me focus on being the best version of me and just letting the chips fall where they may, and not forgetting that I do this for bigger reasons than a plastic trophy or a pro card. But at the same time, I didn't want to lose the fact that I did like the competitive aspect. I wanted to see, like, what is a maxed out Eric Helms? How does he compare to everybody else? You know, and I wouldn't judge myself or feel like I'd failed if it was, you know, never getting my pro card or getting my pro card or being a good pro or being a bad pro or being a world champion or just being the novice tall 07 champ or whatever, never winning nothing ever again. But what I eventually got to, it took years, was I want to max out my potential and see how far I can take it. You know, aim for the stars. If I hit the moon, fantastic. And then also see where does that land me competitively. And but as soon as I saw that gentleman win his pro card at that show where I test judged, and as soon as I saw, you know, Jim Cordova, WNBF pro world champion on the cover of Natural Bodybuilding and Fitness magazine, very early on, I was like, you know what, a long time goal of mine is to get pro status in the World Natural Bodybuilding Federation. There are a lot of different federations out there. I've competed in many. You know, when I lived in the States, I competed in the INBA, the International Natural Bodybuilding Association. I actually won a pro card with the professional arm of that in 2011. I competed with the NGA, the National Gym Association, which has been a long time natural bodybuilding organization. But the goal from probably 2006 that I articulated was, you know, one of the things, like, bucket list item is I want to get my WNBF pro card. And I started competing with the INBF, the amateur arm in the States. In 2009 was the first time I did a WNBF pro qualifying show.
Okay. And as I understand, if I'm going to fast forward us 13 years, 2019, were you, like, close to pro then in one of your last competitions in that year? Am I right about that?
The number of times I've been close, Mickey, was again, I wish it was just 2019, but no. Yeah, okay. So in 2009, so the way you get a pro card is that in a pro qualifying show, which is dictated by, are there enough competitors in your division? And has it been sanctioned as a pro qualifier? Those two things need to be met. The standard at the current time is that there needs to be at least 7 in your division, and it needs to be sanctioned as a pro qualifier. So you've proven to the heads of the organization that it's a good enough show, high enough quality, it attracts enough competitors, and then you actually have to have the numbers. then what needs to happen is you need to win your division and then win the overall. So the you win your weight class and then you win the division overall. So a standard setup, let's say you've got 10 bodybuilders in a pro qualifier, and they weigh in, and you've got four in the lightweights, four in the middleweights, and then three in the heavyweights. The top guy who wins the middles, the lights, and the heavies, those three then go into a comparison, and you're comparing to see who's the best of those three winners. And then that's the overall winner, and that overall winner gets a pro card. There are also higher level amateur shows that are typically called super pro qualifiers. They have to be given a sanction as being able to allow multiple pro cards to be given out. And then they need to have substantially more than seven to be able to give out multiple ones. And they will give them to people in the ranking order of the overall. You can get them within your weight class if the weight class itself has seven or more. So it needs to have eight, right? I think eight, I forget. But so if there's like eight lightweights and you win the lightweights, you're a pro. And then if you go to the overall and there's enough for another pro card, the person who places second to you can get the pro card, right? Or if you place second to them and they place first, they can get a pro card. So there can be sometimes as many as, like, for example, at Worlds for the amateurs is a very, very competitive show. Hundreds of people come out. You have to qualify to even get there. Every single weight class winner, if there's at least the right number in the class, can get a pro card. So they can award five pro cards at Worlds. The bantam, lightweight, middleweight, light heavy, and heavyweight winner win Worlds as well. Attending could all get a pro card. So it depends on the show. So anyway, in 2009, I was in three shows that were pro qualifiers, and I got into two overalls. And placed, I think, third in those, didn't get my pro card. And then in the last show I did, I placed second to the guy in my weight class in the heavyweights who went on to win the overall and get his pro card. And then I basically had a repeat of that in 2019. I placed second in the first show I did of the year in April. In June, I actually won a show that was a pro qualifier, but they didn't have enough athletes in the show to get a pro card. And then in my last show in July, I also placed second in the middleweights and didn't get to go to the overall. So the number of times I've either gotten to the overall, won my class but not won the overall, or placed second to someone and not gotten to go to the overall is like six or seven times. So
okay, yeah. And can you, when you're looking at your progress, Eric, do you look back and think, on reflection, I can see, you know, outside of the numbers thing, like you can see why, what was holding you back, like from a training or a physique perspective, rather than there just weren't enough people there, you know, like the looking at
absolutely
inside, I suppose. Yeah,
no, absolutely. And even in 2023, I had a few other of these kind of bridesmaid experiences, if you will. So when I did the New Zealand show, the WBF New Zealand, I actually won that show. I won the overall, but I was not awarded the pro card, for a combination of factors. There wasn't enough, athletes. And then when you start the federation in a new country, cause it's only the second year that we've had the WBF New Zealand show. There's a panel that decides whether or not you're at a pro standard. So it's a little bit subjective. We're not doing it next year because now we finally have the numbers, and the judging panel themselves can decide whether the pro card is there, and it'll just be based upon numbers. But at that show, they said, hey, you're not quite in peak condition. So it was a leanness issue, right? And in prior years, I probably could have done better if I was leaner in some of my earlier competitions. And other times, it was just I didn't have the size and the symmetry. So like in 2009, the last show I did, I was in very good condition. In terms of leanness, that's a condition, is when bodybuilders say that, they mean basically how lean do you look on stage? Can you see every detail? And then there's the other things that are judged in bodybuilding are your proportionality, which is left to right, top to bottom, front to back symmetry. And do you have a small looking waist, broad shoulders? Do you have what's called an X frame, sweeping quads? And there's no muscle group missing. You know, if you have great, you know, V taper, but you have small legs, that's going to be really challenging to overcome, or vice versa. You know, if you look great from the front, but you turn around and you have no back width, and, you know, you have no glutes, no hamstrings, and no separation there, you know, you're going to lose a lot of points from the back. So I was just too small early in my career, and I don't have a wide waist, but I don't have a small waist. And I don't have narrow shoulders, but I don't have broad shoulders. So for a guy like me, especially at 6 foot, I really need to create a lot of size in my lats and a lot of size in my delts so that from the front, I don't look narrow. When you look at my, there's what's called mandatory poses in bodybuilding. You go through asymmetry rounds where you do front relax, side relax, back relax. They're not relaxed, but you're not flexing any specific muscle group. And then you have 9 muscularity shots. You have a front double bicep, a front lat spread. You turn to the side, then you do a side chest, a side tricep. You turn to the back and you do a back double bicep, a back lat spread. You turn back to the front, and then you're doing a ab and thigh and a different variations of a most muscular pose, right? Those two rounds are graded separately. The symmetry round, at least in the INBF, WNBF, is judged essentially, the best way to describe it is you imagine the person as a silhouette. You don't think about their muscularity, their leanness, et cetera. You're just comparing the silhouettes and it's your symmetry score. And it is, you know, how much of an X frame do they have? How proportioned does everything look? Not how cut is an individual muscle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The muscularity round, you're judging them in those poses. So for a guy like me with my build, I will do very well on side triceps, side chest, because you can't see that I have a wider waist or narrow shoulders, and you just see the amount of muscle mass I'm carrying in my leanness. And if you were just to kind of like weigh my muscles on a scale and not think about how they fit on my frame, I'm not small. But in those front shots, I look narrow. So I've had to work very hard on building my deltoid size, my lat size, and my quads. I haven't had to work that hard on my quads because I have naturally big legs, but my upper body specifically width, I've had to specialize in. And that really didn't improve to the point where it made my physique look complete and symmetrical until this year. Even in 2019, there was an incompleteness to my physique that made it challenging for me to win, even when I was in peak condition. And 2019 was the leanest I'd ever been at that point, like exceeding even a good standard of condition. And the feedback I got from the judges was you need more size, which is that and the pandemic is why it took 4 years to compete again. So
yeah, super interesting. And Eric, I'd love to chat to you about 2023 and the process whereby you ended up with your pro card. And this is the bit where, you know, I mean, this is super interesting regardless of whether you're interested in this in sport or in bodybuilding in general, because of course it brings in, you know, the nutrition side of things. That, I mean, listen to the bias. Yeah, I'm super interested in the nutrition, actually.
Sure.
And I remember, actually, you and I were, we were at a lunch for Holistic Performance Institute, and you said, yeah, I've begun dieting or something. I'm like, oh, are you tracking? And you were like, no, not tracking at this point. And as I understand it, you sort of, I mean, it makes sense, right? Because you've just been doing this for close to 2 decades, that you've just got this innate knowledge of what's in food. You can sort of look at something and pretty much estimate what, how many calories it has. But can you talk me through your process on the nutrition piece and how you sort of went from, in April or whatever, right through to September and changes you made?
Yeah, absolutely. So big picture, what people are generally doing is in modern competitive bodybuilding, in the bodybuilding division for natural athletes, you have to get really, 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 really lean. We can't get as big as the enhanced guys. So the way that we look most impressive, and this is true even in the enhanced ranks, is to have zero visible subcutaneous fat.
Yes, so you can see all the muscles and regardless of the size of them. Yeah,
and even someone who is not that big, who is truly peeled and just shredded, it's a sight to behold because it's a level of detail. The muscles pop, you can see everything flex. They look much bigger than they do in clothes. Me on stage in peak condition, it's like any decent, you know, natural bodybuilder, they're like, oh wow, that's really impressive. And then me, as soon as I get off stage, and I put on like a shirt, especially one that I'd wear in the off season when I'm, you know, 15 kilos heavier.
Yeah.
All of a sudden I look like I'm someone who is maybe just come out of chemo, you know? So, because your face is sunken, you've lost all the body fat on your face, you know, especially if you're like a little dehydrated or tired on the day, which is very common when you have low energy availability. First thing in the morning, it's like, wow, like I look like a skull shrink wrapped, you know, with skin on it. So that is very much an illusion. And the way you get to it is by getting very, very, very lean. And that takes a while. So the standard kind of length of a prep for someone who gets to elite levels in conditioning and men's natural bodybuilding and what the standard is currently today is typically around 6 months. Anywhere from probably like 4 to 8 is what you'll hear if you talk to competitors and shows. People who aren't in shape, typically it's shorter than that. And this is also somewhat the competitive structure. You know, Worlds is typically the second or third week in November. And there are pro qualifiers and Worlds qualifiers for amateurs all the way from like March or April all the way up to, you know, 2 weeks prior to Worlds. So it takes, so you know, I started my diet in February and with the intention of going all the way to Worlds and competing in November, right? So
and what body weight were you at in February?
I started at 96, and that was definitely like a bloated high body weight because by the end of the week, I was like a 94. So, you know, some of that is not reflective of body composition. So I was about 15 kilos after the initial bloat loss over stage weight.
And sorry, Eric.
Yeah, yeah.
When I think about your preparation in 2019, what was the highest weight that you were sort of at before you started dieting down?
Yeah, there was a time in 2018 where I got up to 98. But when I actually started my prep, I was like 89, 90. So I did 2018, I pushed my body weight up and really tried to just have kind of a concentrated gaining phase. And then I spent March and April of 2018 and then a brief period in October in 2018, bringing my body weight down to a better place to start my diet. And then I basically ate around maintenance or a very slight surplus for November, December, and then started my prep in 2019, just like 10 kilos over stage weight, because I compete right around 80 kilos.
And is it more comfortable, is that sort of around 10 kilos above stage weight a comfortable place for you to be compared to, say, 15 kilos above?
You know, they're both within like my, where I could settle, you know, I'm actually kind of exploring this off season to figure out like, hey, how lean can I be post show and feel relatively healthy? And you know, like not be food focused, be sleeping normally, et cetera. And you know, the more time you have, more runway you have for a gaining phase, the more optimized and efficient that process is. Cause at a certain stage after the novice stage of building muscle, if you're in a calorie surplus because of the kind of the rate limiting step of how quickly can you gain muscle as a natural athlete who's already built 90% of the muscle you're ever going to be able to build on based on your genetics, the rate is slow. You can only gain so much in a given time period. And it's also spurty. Like you'll like introduce a novel training program and you've assessed some things and you land on the right combination and you make great gains for like 10 weeks and then it's grind. So it's not necessarily linear either, but it is, no matter how you dice it, relatively slower the more advanced you are to gain muscle compared to earlier. So you're going to gain body fat with it. And because I'm competing in a sport where I have to get down to having basically no visible subcutaneous body fat, you only want to get so heavy and then you want to kind of rein it in. So you either, you take a slow, steady approach, or you can take a faster approach and you have to do what's called mini cuts or off-season cuts in the off season. And I basically do a combination of both. I go as slow as is reasonable with the level of precision that one can have and still eating a normalish diet for a bodybuilder. And then once my body fat gets to a certain level, I cut back. So that was up to 98 in 2018. And I allowed myself, you know, basically a slow gain from 20, you know, after my season ended in 2019 to getting as heavy as 96 kilos in, early 2023, right? And it's hard for me to get above like 94, 95. That's where I really feel like I'm probably at what Speakman and colleagues would describe as my upper intervention point, where my hunger is, you know, like almost gone. I get satiated very easy. I feel like my energy expenditure is at the highest it is. And it feels like work. Like I've never been able to push myself up to 100 kilos except for like my very first season after show when I was like binge eating. And when my metabolism hadn't recovered. So yeah, the heaviest I've ever been able to intentionally push my weight up was not unintentionally from binge eating, was 100 kilos in 2010. And that was very hard work. And that was back when I was under the impression that you really had to bulk to get bigger. So my off seasons have actually gotten progressively lighter, but I was a little heavier in 2023 to start than I was in 2019. But my peak weight was actually lower in the off season by 2 kilos.
And where do you think like you'll end up in this sort of build phase? So if you're trying to,
That's a good question. I'm right around 87.
Yeah.
So I'm like, 15 pounds over stage weight, seven kilos. And this has been an interesting one because for the first time, now that I actually turned pro after, finally getting this goal that I set in 2006 and 2023, so 17 years later, now I'm competing against pros, right? So if I had to scrape and crawl to the point where I turned pro and was able to play seventh out of ninth, now I've got the goal of trying to place fifth at Worlds when I do decide to get back on stage or higher, top five, which is a tall order. No pun intended because of my height in bodybuilding. I was the tallest middleweight. It's a tall order for someone who is, it took long as I did to become a good enough amateur to turn pro. To do that, I have decided to be very focused in my approach. So, well, this has very, very much been about, Eric, the bodybuilder. My goals from the start were always strength and size. The first competitive endeavor I had in the kind of the Iron Game umbrella was actually powerlifting in 2006. And I've done 20 powerlifting meets, 5 weightlifting meets, a Highland Games competition, and 2 strongman competitions in my, since 2006, right? So I've done more strength sport competitions than I have done bodybuilding. Bodybuilding, I think I've done 17 or 18 shows over the years.
I've heard you talk about that and that you like, I think your description was you'd come in a solid B minus. I think if you had to rate yourself in that sort of strength based sport, whereas in bodybuilding, you've got more potential to reach a higher potential, obvious and as evidenced by your pro card last year, I guess.
Yeah. And like, there's multiple ways to kind of quantify that, but like, If I was to look at like what's the best total I've ever done, and if I did that at a lighter weight class and I optimized everything, and where do I think my peak capacity is as a power lifter, it'd probably be like totaling mid 600s at 83 with a tough weight cut, but just kind of sneaking in under there. And that would be good enough to get me like a decent performance as a master's competitor. In the open division, I would not qualify for Worlds. And if I was in the even smaller, less powerlifting developed nation than New Zealand, and I could get to Worlds, I would place, I think in Malta, I would have placed like not dead last, but like 34th or something like that, in IPF Worlds, which is the powerlifting federation that's drug tested. So, I qualify for nationals for New Zealand, I think last year at nationals, when I looked at it, I would have placed 7th at New Zealand nationals.
Yeah.
And probably in the 20s for the U.S. nationals, kind of give you some comparison.
Yeah.
But in bodybuilding, I have won the equivalent of nationals in New Zealand. I've won multiple smaller shows, and now I've actually placed 7th in the pro division at Worlds. So it's not as big of a sport. But I have done some reasonably large shows and competed against some pretty high level competitors. Most of the people who have beat me are pros now. I can't think of anyone who's placed higher than me who didn't eventually get a pro card. So while my physique may not have the structure to handle 600 pound squats, I am pretty, I guess you could say. So to give you some perspective, like someone who placed 7th at Worlds in the 83 kilo class in the open is totaling 100 kilos more than me.
Crazy,
right? So it's something that is just it's not in the realm of possibility for my body.
Yeah, Yeah, great. Yeah. No, I hear that. Eric, how, so obviously in 2023, you started at 96 and then you used that sort of intuitive approach for how long until you actually started to have to, I don't know, did you ever count, like, I believe you were like ballparking calories, but how did that sort of, how did that progress?
Yeah, so I mean, it is important to stress that in my first three seasons, I did have like specific targets for macros, and I weighed them and I hit them all the time. And it's just that I've found that having a more auto-regulated approach, if you have the skill set to do that, has some advantages to it, and it is one less stressor to the competitor. If unless they actually like it and benefit from it, then you make an argument you keep it in, even though they could eyeball it. And it's not about tracking. It's about reaching the outcome, right? So is the target rate of weight loss ideal? Yeah. And are you hitting sufficient minimal thresholds for carbohydrates, fat, and protein? Are you having a good qualitative, healthily sport performance supportive diet, right? And if you can achieve that without tracking, fantastic. And if you can auto-regulate it based upon hunger, satiety, energy levels, performance, sleep, and knowing when to kind of pull back the stress and institute it, when to strike as far as chasing weight loss versus allowing recovery. If you can have an intuitive sense of those things, that's an advantage, but not everyone does, right? That takes experience, which I fortunately have. So how did I do that? Initially, weight loss is very easy. When all those same reasons why I couldn't even push past 96 kilos is the same reason why the weight started falling off me quite easily. And as a nutritionist, you'll appreciate this. A lot of it was just swapping and maintaining the same lifestyle. I had a good structure of eating, and that's something I've had for a decade plus now, where I eat kind of the same qualitative meals all the time, and I have the same habits. So every morning I go on a walk with my wife and we go eat at a cafe. I'm now just making very different decisions, right? So when prep starts now, I'm having, poached eggs on toast with a side of salmon, mushrooms and spinach, not a bowl of oatmeal, a side of salmon and eggs, right? You know, so calories are getting cut easily there by 300, if not more. Lunch, I'm having, like a nothing naughty protein bar, either like a vegetable, protein, like with lentils and two pieces of fruit and a carrot. Now it's one piece of fruit, and I'm making that protein a little leaner with less of the lentils and more, but just the protein itself. Boom, I've cut 200, 300 calories there. My post-workout shake, I'm having that alone without a carb source, like I would in the off season, would also be a carb source. And then for dinner, essentially all we started doing is we just started eliminating some of the really high calorie options. When we make food at home, instead of having like veggie burgers with a block of feta as the cheese and a slice of full fat cheese and barbecue sauce on it, now we're having wraps, right? So we go from having an 800 calorie dinner to a 500 calorie dinner. And when we have the option of eating out, we're not going to get Sal's on Saturday. Maybe I'm going to get sushi, So my dinners were dropping 300 to 400 calories as well. So I've already accumulated a 700 calorie drop from my norm just with those qualitative changes that feel quite similar to me. And then before I go to bed, instead of having a sweetened Greek yogurt, I'm just having a plain one that I add equal to, and I've cut another 100 calories. So it very easily created a 1,000 calorie deficit with these qualitative changes that I'm not tracking. I'm just making those swaps. And then I'm also making sure I get a certain step count. And on the days I can't hit that step count, I'm just doing a quick cardio session on my rower. And I dropped very quick. Not too quick. Performance was increasing. But I dropped from 96 to, I want to say, the high 80s by March.
Yeah, amazing. Eric, what around what protein intake would you have? I mean, I imagine you have an idea of that. Just curious.
Yeah. I was probably between 190 and 220.
Yeah.
Grams. Yeah. So each meal is probably around 40, and then I've got on workout days it's probably closer to that higher number I mentioned, because I got to scoop away, and then I get a big bolus from the Greek yogurt that I eat before to go to bed. That's like 50 grams right there.
Oh wow, Anka high protein yogurt.
I actually like the skier. So.
Oh, yes. No, I appreciate that. Yeah. And so at what point, so you got to sort of the high 80s, and when did you realize that you would actually need to be a little bit more precise with your calories?
Well, the interesting thing is basically the lower your numbers get, and as far as what do you need to institute a deficit, the more precise you have to be. And this is just a function of numbers, right? So like, and it's also a function of the rate of weight loss that you should try to achieve. So when you're trying to go from, I was probably, 20% body fat, trying to go down to teens, you can lose faster without really having a physiological impact. You're moving within the upper and lower intervention point, again, as speak my colleagues would define it. Less potential for a downside to losing on the faster side, right? But once you're trying to go from, say, 12% body fat to 8% body fat, or from 8% body fat, even more so, to 5% body fat, if we're guesstimating where I eventually hit, now you should be losing slower because you can only lose fat so fast. And if you push it higher than that, you notice that you get very, very flat, lethargic, you feel poor, your sleep gets worse, and your performance goes down, presumably due to pretty substantial glycogen depletion and a lot of signals that respond to acute low energy availability and the downstream effects there, and probably some muscle loss if you can keep that up for too long. So you don't want to lose too quickly because you can't rush the process. That's something anecdotally that most coaches I've experienced and athletes will tell you, like, okay, it looks like I'm 5 pounds of fat over stage weight. If I try to get there in 5 weeks, it's not going to go well, even though that seems like a reasonable rate of weight loss for normal fat loss conditions. And I could even go faster than that back when I was 96 kilos. But when I'm 96 kilos, I've got 15 kilos of fat on me I'm going to lose, right?
Yeah.
But when I'm 83, I've only got 3 kilos of fat on me left to lose. So the relative proportion of 0.5 kilos is much higher. So, if you have 3 kilos left to lose to get into true high level, elite level of conditioning, you're probably looking at 10 weeks of dieting, right? To do that without pushing it too quickly. And there may even need to be like a diet break or a week off there to get there. So therefore, your calorie intake is going to be lower and you need to be more precise because you're only trying to institute maybe a 200 calorie deficit, right? So if your error on any given day is 100 calories, you could be eating up half your deficit, and that's precise if you're only off by 100 calories and guesstimating. So there was a certain point probably by, I want to say, June, July, where Berto and I were no longer just going qualitatively let this happen and have your step count here. We were going, all right, let's have a calorie intake range and let's have a step count range. And you can auto-regulate within those based upon what you're seeing, the rate of weight loss and how far we are from competition, energy levels, mood, et cetera. And, what are my life demands on a day-to-day basis outside of bodybuilding? If I've got 3 meetings with students at AUT, I don't want to be like lethargic and unfocused. So that's not a day to strike, right? So I went all the way from early Feb until through, I would say, May. I remember we did an April seminar in Mexico, myself and Alberto, and I was still eyeballing it and just kind of letting it happen. May carried on. And I think in June was where we started to actually talk about numbers. And at that point, I was, I still wasn't necessarily weighing food or tracking it all the time. But I was having a running goal in my head, like, okay, I know where I'm at. And then any time that I would make something at home where I didn't feel confident eyeballing it, just chuck it on the scale.
Yeah.
And any time where we're eating out, I would just make the trick to eating out is you make decisions where even if you are wrong, the impact is very negligible, right? Because you can think you're great at eyeballing, and you might be, but it is literally impossible to tell the difference between a pasta dish where there's one additional tablespoon of oil in it or not.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
You just can't tell, right? And the chef does not care about your nutrition plan, right?
Yeah.
So if you got to a restaurant and you're estimating a pasta dish, it is a true estimation. And there could be a 200 calorie swing quite easily, even if you're quite good at engaging other things. But if you go to a restaurant and you get a grilled chicken breast on salad. Okay, so let's say you think it's 2 cups of salad and it's actually 3. It's lettuce and your dressing is on the side. You're off by 5 calories. It just can't hurt you. Okay, it's a grilled chicken breast. You thought it was 100 grams. It was 150. Oh boy, 40 calories. Like it just doesn't really matter that much, right? So that's the type of thing where if you make the right decision, your potential error is going to be, a lot lower. And if your average estimation is quite precise, then it it doesn't make a difference. And ultimately, the proof is in the pudding. Like, if my scale weight's not going down, if I'm not getting leaner, then I'm clearly making systematic errors. That didn't happen. I got in great shape and won my pro card. So the approach definitely worked, but I was being more precise and more careful and much more discerning later on in prep than I was earlier on, because when I'm instituting a 900 to 1100 calorie deficit, an error still means I'm losing weight at a good clip. And I'm the type of person, if you were to talk to Berto, who is my collaborative coach who I work with, and one of my other colleagues, along with Jeff and Brad and Brian, I have more of a tendency to undershoot than over when prepping, because my mindset is like, let's get leaner. And he serves to make sure that I don't chase too hard and actually eat up lean mass or burn myself out. Not that it would be extreme or terrible, but like, it is really a game of let's preserve as much willpower, minimal amount of stress, least amount of suffering as possible, because getting to elite level standards of conditioning and natural bodybuilding in 2023 and 2024 is not just a willpower game. It is that plus a needing to stay in the game and making sure that you preserve your physiology to allow you to get there. So if you can make it feel easier, you can push yourself further to get a better result. So you have to be both efficient and smart and work hard.
And I know we're talking bodybuilding here, but I just think that's such an important point to reiterate to anyone in that who wants to improve their body composition. Exactly what you've described with you undershoot, because it's almost, you know, you've got this, you're not impatient, but you just want to get as lean as possible. Yeah. And as you said, then you have to instigate willpower and discipline and all the things which aren't infinite.
Yes,
exactly. So if you can hold out and use willpower when you need to use willpower, then, you know, regardless of your goal, it just makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
Eric, I understand that you had, the way that you structured it for yourself was having some low days and some high days. So you did a bit of calorie cycling. Did you put those high calorie days in on days where you had heavier training loads, or does that not? In my experience, it's individual as to whether that's helpful for someone or whether, you know, on they're better on another day. So how did you work it for you?
No, it's the same experience I've had as well, is that it really depends on a lot of factors, volume of training, assumptions we have about the type of substrate that person gravitates towards using more at rest and in exercise, their subjective feelings, whether they go hypo or not, and just a lot of individual characteristics. And so for me, I think the way we structured it was that I had the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, as my high calorie days that were, you know, in the low 2000s up to mid 2000s. And then anywhere from, say, like at the very, very, very lowest during prep, 1400 to up to like 1700. But most of the time upshifted for most of prep by a couple hundred calories there, like 1600 to 1900 calories on low days. And then we even got to a point where I had two even lower days, where I would do that on Friday and Monday. So the rationale there is that Friday, the light's already right there at the end of the tunnel, at least psychologically, you've got your two refeeds coming up. And then on Monday, you just came off of two high days, you know, both physiologically and psychologically, you'll probably be fine on a low day. Glycogen's topped off. If you're training earlier in the day, it's really not much to do with what did you have at breakfast and lunch anyway. It has to do with these 48 hours of refeeding. You can have good performance. And then we would structure my training so that my most important body parts that were weakest for me were trained on Monday with the most effective, most stimulative fatiguing exercises. And then we would get the work done on my body parts, which seemed, you know, more gifted, more likely to hold on the mass, just better structure and shape, that even if they did lose some muscle, it wouldn't hurt me as much later in the week as my cumulative deficit was adding up. So absolutely a consideration. For some general kind of guidance for people, you know, if you do want to try to benefit from a high calorie day for a training session, the next morning is a good time to train if you only have one high calorie day, because it takes time to store glycogen. You can't really effectively store a ton of glycogen on the same day if we look at the research on this. So you now, that said, you don't want to be hungry going into a training session. some of the research that we've done as a part of extra local PhD student Andrew King, is that peri-workout nutrition does help volume performance. When we aggregated enough, we did a meta-analysis on that published in Sports Medicine. And it seems to some degree independent of the dose of carbohydrate. It's just, did you eat something or not, right? But it does seem to be impacted by the volume of training. So there is some, you know, gut-brain connection or, you know, volume-dependent thing. It may not be directly related to glycogen storage or the amount of substrate you have available, but not going into it with low blood glucose levels or low glycogen levels or having hunger, all those things could potentially impede acute performance. So, you know, if you're looking to enhance training with acute feeding, if you want to cross all your potential tick boxes of what's going to lead to good performance, then you want to be going into the session with reasonably topped off glycogen, and you want to go into it fed, even if it's just one meal, so that you're not feeling acutely hungry. So I think some people think, all right, well, I'm training at 3 p.m. today. Today needs to be the refeed. It's like, well, you're going to have lunch and breakfast, maybe a little bit bigger than normal, but are you, you're certainly not topping off your glycogen if that came off 6 days of dieting. So for me, I had Sunday off and I trained Saturday, and then I would train Monday. So I would have, you know, one day training reasonably hard, but not super hard. Like I said, end of the week is kind of the lower priority sessions. Sunday completely off with a high day. And then I feel great on Monday with my most high priority training session. So absolutely, yeah, we did leverage some of that timing.
Yeah. But was it carbohydrate that you increased your calories from?
Mostly, but fat did go up as well. It wasn't like me trying to find really low fat, high carb sources, but it would, the proportion of carbs would increase on those days more than anything else.
Yeah. Any supplements, Eric, that you would just take? Yeah. How did that look for you?
Very basic. Creatine. I really actually reduced my caffeine intake a lot this last prep because I wanted to preserve my sleep quality. So no pre-workout. I was just doing coffee with breakfast. There were occasional times where I just felt like I was totally dragging ass and I would have, you know, like 100 milligrams of caffeine, nothing crazy. Again, I'm pretty heavy. That's a pretty small dose. That's the only actual like ergogenic supplement I take. Besides that, it was just, you know, whey protein to reach my targets and like multivitamin and fish oil. So one thing I would say is that somewhere between 10 to 30% of all supplements are adulterated or contaminated with things that are not supposed to be in there.
Yeah.
Based upon the most recent, like, best guesses we have based on the evidence. Really good review paper on that by Yeagim and colleagues that was published at the end of 2023. And coming out on the 1st of March, I wrote an article all about this for Mass, which is going to be available for anyone to read, not even a subscriber. It's our cover story. It's free. I think it's really important. So anyone would do well to only take third-party tested supplements, in my opinion, especially a drug-tested athlete, because contamination can occur at the manufacturer level. It can occur at the supplement company level intentionally. And if it's occurring at the manufacturer level just because they used a shipping container that had something else in it prior and it wasn't properly cleaned, it's going to be at such a low dose that it won't even have a measurable impact on you. But the precision of drug tests these days are so high that that'll pick up and you can pop. And you're not even benefiting from the inadvertent doping you're doing. You're just failing a drug test and ruining your life.
What's your brand of creatine, Eric?
I typically do Optimum Nutrition. They have they do third party testing and they're available here locally. So yeah,
nice one. Yeah, Eric. At what point in your prep does Barbara start to go, far out, Eric? You're just turning into an asshole. Like, is that when you really know? Okay, now I'm digging deep.
You know, the funny thing is I do check with her all the time. Like, how am I?
Yeah.
How am I doing?
Yeah.
And this season, and she's always very candid with me. She has been from the very beginning.
Of course.
And this is probably the best I've done in terms of like irritation and being a dick or letting my mood state affect her. I think that the thing she got tired of was actually just my athletic focus. So not my interpersonal interactions, but just the fact that every day I'd get up, I'd assess my physique in the mirror, I'd track my weight. And you know, make some comment because I'm laser focused, especially when we got close to the shows. Like I competed on the 30th of September, and then I competed the next two. I competed five times over an 8 week period. So from being like 2 weeks out from the New Zealand show, so mid September all the way through to mid November, So basically September, October, November, 3 months straight, I was competing like at least, I was always 2 weeks out or competing the next weekend. And I had, you know, I flew to Australia once and the States twice for these shows. And so like my mindset during that period was like, got to dial it in. Like, you know, I'm coming home in various states of having spray tan fading off me. I'm having to ask her, hey, can you put Nair on my back? Cause I can't reach it. Yeah. She's got to drive me to the airport.
Yeah.
So it was mostly just of, okay, our life is like, my interactions with you are what's present on your mind is bodybuilding.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, when she gave me feedback, she was like, I think that would have been true if you were a cyclist though. So it wasn't necessarily the diet. It was just like,
I was going to say that too. Yeah. How you described it is like, you're an athlete. Yeah.
So that wasn't always the case. And I think for most people, this is, you know, you are fighting against disordered eating, body image concerns, and, you know, obsessive compulsive things that all get exacerbated by the process of contest prep and learning how to manage that. And at the very least, pretend to be normal and, you know, tell yourself, look, the food's going to be there tomorrow. This is, you know, like all of the things that come with being in an extreme deficit for a long time and getting very, very lean are what makes the sport so hard. Potentially transformative in a positive way, but also in a negative way. And if you don't watch that, and if you don't have people in your corner who'll be honest with you, and if you don't do things to mitigate that, it can be bad, and it can be a net negative people in their lives. And that's kind of the whole mission statement I have, is to help people get more good than bad and make it worth it, and that they can do bodybuilding on their own terms for as long as they want in a sustainable way.
Mm. So Eric, it's, you know, as you said, you did, what was it, 5 competitions over 8 weeks. You got your pro card, which is amazing, you know, and such, but it's not like the journey ends there.
No.
So is 2024 a year that includes competing, or is this just a phase of building? Like, what does this look like for you now?
Yeah, I'm under no illusions that I will be able to easily become a competitive pro based on how long it took me to become a pro in the first instance. But what I mentioned about how I've always competed in strength sport and physique sport, that's changed. So my entire training focus is now on bodybuilding. And that is, there's a lot of overlap between strength sport and bodybuilding. And if you took the average person and they said, hey, I want to get big, their program wouldn't look that much different to someone who says, hey, I want to get really strong in all my different movements. There'd be some differences, but at a certain level, like once you get to a high enough level, you know, well, I'll take an endurance athlete as an example. A novice or intermediate endurance athlete, if they go do cycling when they're actually a runner, it's a nice cross-training experience to give their knees and feet a break, right? Mm-hmm. If you take an elite-level marathon runner and you take a whole block and do primarily cycling, they're going to get slower, not faster, in their run, right? It's not specific enough. Their adaptations are at such a precarious high level that they'll regress to being a high-level intermediate. So it's the kind of thing where, just like with weightlifting, like you take someone who's never lifted before and they start doing one hard set of bicep curls a week, their arm's going to get bigger. You take someone who's been doing bicep curls for 20 years and they do 10 sets a week, they start doing one set, they're going to probably lose some arm size, you know? So what that means is that for me to be my best in powerlifting and my best in bodybuilding, I actually can't. I can be the best I can be in both simultaneously, which has always been my goal until now. But now that I see the possibility of me actually placing and maybe meddling at Worlds, if I just really milk every last bit of potential out of me, I don't feel that compromise is one that it's worth it. So I have entirely retooled for the first time in 20 years of training, my focus to be completely focused on building muscle and exclusively on my bodybuilding endeavors, which wasn't something I ever wanted to do previously because I love strength sport. But now that I see, I don't want to have any regrets for bodybuilding, and I don't have regrets for powerlifting because I like me getting 1% better in powerlifting is like, sweet. Now you're 6th at nationals, right? In the masters division. And for me, getting 1% better in bodybuilding could mean moving up from 6th place to 5th place and you know, getting a medal and getting to hold my country's flag and stuff like that. So
yeah, amazing.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
So no competition because dieting isn't conducive to building muscle. The earliest I plan to compete is 2025. And if I don't think I've made substantial improvements by 2025, I'll even push it back to 2026.
Yeah. Because I mean, where you're at, like it's that 1% gain. It feels so like it's a huge amount of work. It's a lot. Yeah. And I understand, Eric, that you're documenting it with the 3D MJ team on like YouTube. You've got a vlog that's sort of going through, you know, I don't know how often you're doing that, but people can follow
about twice a month. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
We just released episode 6 last weekend, and it's with me, with one of the other coaches, Brian Miner, who is, we're doing like off-season coaching together. He's collaborative programming and things and, you know, game planning, like at what rate should I gain weight? Where do I want to get my off-season weight up to? And I will say that as hard as I anticipated it to be to put on muscle at this stage in my career, the shift to emphasizing all of my efforts towards bodybuilding has been surprisingly effective already.
Oh, awesome.
In my last update, episode 6, I did a side-by-side comparison of me walking around at 86 versus 84, like a 2 kilogram difference at very similar body fat, but substantially fuller. And for that to have occurred at the like 12-week mark post-show, where a large part of that was also occurring during my recovery phase, where I'm thinking I'm just, you know, getting back up to normal, we're very pleasantly surprised. So it goes to show just that there was a bit of a bottleneck with me trying to also be the best powerlifter I could be simultaneously. Because I did do actually a powerlifting meet in the middle of my prep in July. I competed in North Islands. So even when you institute just a bit of powerlifting, it's hard to work up to a 200 kilo squat before you do the rest of your leg day. Or work up to especially when you're dieting and you're light, you know, pulling 230 kilos before then you go do an upper body workout and deadlifts. It takes a toll. And those energies have been better spent. And the joint stress and recovery demands are much lower, has allowed me to do substantially more work. And unfortunately, I'm not one of those people who responds to like low volume, high intensity training. I respond to high volume, high frequency, high intensity training. Like,
yeah.
It's been a very straightforward equation. I have to do more and I have to do it harder.
Yeah.
So all of that real estate of recovery that needs to be used for me to kind of milk the most out of me. And I can tell you as a coach, that's not the case for many people. There are lots of people who they can do more volume, but they don't benefit from it. And it's work that's being done that's not stimulative. And you know, they do much, much better when they constrain their volume and put forth more effort and more strategic and exercise selection. But then there's other people who just need more.
And you're one of them.
I'm one of them. So it's like, you know, I need more time in the gym. I need to be time efficient. I need to spend it well. So it's a fun journey. I'm enjoying it. I'm loving my training. And it's probably the best gains I've had in years since maybe like 2011 when I first realized that I needed to do more work for my upper body to get it to grow successfully.
Yeah. Well, Eric, I'm just so pleased for you because of, you know, as I've said, you know, I've followed along at least for the last couple of years when you've spoken about bodybuilding and just what your sort of goals are. And it's always just so lovely to see people be able to realize those goals. And then also for you to have like the potential to sort of get better and, you know, push forth as well. I think that's really awesome. So where can people find you? I know I've probably mentioned a few places, but just to finish us off.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So depends. If you want to learn more about my own bodybuilding journey, the youtube.com/team3dmj, you can catch up on my my series called Believe 2024, Forging the Unlikely Pro Champion. And also all the other coaches' vlogs, all the information we have up there. It's a really good information source. For those who are more on the nerdy side and want to learn more about nutrition and you're like, oh, wait, you wrote an article for what now? You want to go to massresearchreview.com where we do monthly reviews of the most important and relevant information that came out in the scientific literature for practitioners or athletes. So, choose your poison and enjoy it. Drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, that is awesome, Eric. And of course, we'll put links in the show notes to that and to Iron Culture. And for like, Mass is amazing. I'm a subscriber. I love it. And it isn't just for people who are interested in bodybuilding. It really is for anyone interested in the health and fitness space. So
absolutely. I'm the resident bodybuilder, but there's also Lauren Colenso Semple, Eric Trexler, and Mike Zurgo. So health, performance, psychology, you name it.
It's all there. Yeah. Awesome, Eric. Thanks so much for your time. Have the best day.
You too. Thank you, Mickey.
Alrighty, hopefully you enjoyed that as much as I enjoyed chatting to Eric. And as I said, you can find all of the information for Eric in the show notes. Next week on the podcast, I am delighted to bring to you a conversation that I have with Dr. Anna Lemke. She is the author of The Dopamine Nation. Until then, though, why don't you sign up to my webinar, The Hierarchy of Hormone Support, which is a masterclass in simple and effective strategies for you to optimize hormone health. And we will put a link to the show notes to that as well. Send me a DM or a message on Threads, Twitter, or Instagram at Mickey Willardin, Facebook at Mickey Willardin Nutrition, or head to my website, mickeywillardin.com, and sign up for that webinar there. And it is taking place on Sunday, the 7th of April. All right, team, you have the best week, and we'll talk to you soon. See you later.